Now, with those thoughts about whistleblowing and the dangers and difficulties thereof in mind, and yes, physical attacks on whistleblowers are relatively rare, but in terms of the deep state, whistleblowing about false flag terrorism has got to be about the most dangerous sort of whistleblowing one could engage in. With that as a backdrop, then we return to reading from Brian Bogart's essay on the sins of statecraft. He's addressing the subject of the 1979 Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism, which was seminal in developing the ideology of the then unremarked, but now all too familiar, global war on terrorism. In 1982, within just a few years of this conference, Philip Paul, the master's degree student at San Francisco State University, used his thesis to demonstrate that the JCIT's literature and source documentation was profoundly flawed, with authors often citing each other and altering official documents. Its assertion that there was a tenfold increase in international terrorism between 1968 and 1978 had been deliberately fabricated and contradicted CIA data showing a decline. According to Ahmed, quote, "It was also routinely applied on techniques of blatant disinformation, misquoting and misrepresenting Western intelligence reports, as well as recycling government-sponsored disinformation published in the mainstream media." Paul thus concludes that the 1979 JCIT was, quote, "a successful propaganda operation. The entire notion of international terrorism, as promoted by the Jerusalem Conference, rests on a faulty, dishonest, and ultimately corrupt information base. The issue of international terrorism has little to do with fact or any objective legal definition. The issue, as promoted by the JCIT and used by the Reagan administration, is an ideological and instrumental issue. It is the ideology, rather than the reality, that dominates U.S. foreign policy today." Unquote. Nevertheless, Ahmed continues, quote, "The new ideology of international terrorism justified the Reagan administration's shift to a renewed interventionist foreign policy and legitimized a new alliance between right-wing dictators everywhere and the government. Thus, the administration had moved to legitimate their politics of state terrorism and repression, while also alleviating pressure for the reform of the intelligence community and opening the door for aggressive and sometimes illegal intelligence action in the course of fighting the international terrorist threat." Unquote. In other words, this plan was similar in nature to the Team B assault on intelligence, in that it was an effort to fan Cold War flames and produce stronger intelligence community cover for continued and further imperial projections, which was the primary purpose of the US-USSR Cold War in the first place, as University of Chicago professor history Bruce Cummings and East Asia expert and former CIA analyst Chalmers Johnson suggest. Upon taking office in January 1981, Reagan outlined his new foreign policy in a speech by Alexander Haig, which boiled down to an adaptation of the JCIT theme. Quote, "International terrorism will take the place of human rights in our concern." Unquote. Thus, the 1979 U.S. destabilization program, using terrorist groups to lure Soviets into Afghanistan, was used by the U.S. to call the Soviet invasion terrorism and to point to that invasion as a model for Soviet-backed terrorism around the world. A nation of such greed and superior strength will often allow itself to be attacked because it can afford to do so, and because in the minds of a negative activist minority, it makes strategic sense to do so. In Inventing the Axis of Evil, Bruce Cummings notes that,
"From Polk's attack on Mexico to the South's shelling of Fort Sumter, the incident of the Maine and the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, the Korean War, the Tonkin Gulf incident, and Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, presidents who were bent on war or not, expecting it to erupt or not, nonetheless waited until the enemy made the first move."
Cummings goes on to point out that the George W. Bush administration's invasion of Iraq did not fit that typical pattern, though it is now clear from the documents and statements, many of them authored by Paul Wolfowitz, that this administration and its supporting base of influential negative activist groups was obsessed with the Middle East intervention and global domination via force long before they took office, with Iraq as their first stepping stone. Thus, 9/11 was a plausible pretext, and one for which President Bush's administration was willing to wait. Paul Wolfowitz's obsession with Iraq dates back to at least 1973. It was then that Wolfowitz, who had studied under the pro-Cold War nuclear weapons advocate Albert Wohlstetter at the University of Chicago, and whose father had been Albert Wohlstetter's math teacher at Columbia University, visited the Pentagon and asked why there were no war room contingencies for the Persian Gulf. Later, while serving under President Carter in the capacity of Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Regional Programs and tasked with generating a limited contingency study to examine possible third world threats in regions including the Middle East, Wolfowitz voiced the view that no attention was being paid to the possibility of the Soviets turning southward to seize the oil fields of the Persian Gulf. He advised the deployment of military equipment to the Gulf, but his advice was rejected. Indeed, the first written expression of such Middle East contingencies appeared in the 1977 Military Strategy and Force Posture Review, authorized by President Carter, also known as Presidential Review Memorandum 10/NSC-10, which incorporated Wolfowitz's studies. After joining the Reagan administration, his advice was accepted, and tankers of military equipment were anchored in the Persian Gulf, and later used by George Bush Sr. In 1986, according to Ahmed, quote, "Osama bin Laden's activities occurred with the full approval of the Saudi regime and the CIA. Under contract with the CIA, he and the family company built the multi-billion-dollar caves known as the Tora Bora complex to serve as a major arms storage depot, training facility, and medical center for the Mujahideen." Unquote. With CIA support to override visa requirements, Osama rounded up recruits and sent them into the United States for terrorist training by the CIA. Could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. He said he doesn't know if he can. And now we're going to have a 20-minute section of an interview with Michael Springman. This is courtesy of a podcast I found at visibility911.com.
J. Michael Springman is a former diplomat who worked for the State Department. He has served in Germany, India, and probably most importantly for purposes of this broadcast, he served as the chief of the visas division for the American Consulate General at Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Now, it was reported a few days after 9/11 by the LA Times that 15 of the 19 alleged 9/11 hijackers got their visas from the very department that Mr. Springman had worked for years before. And Michael Springman has been out talking a lot about what he saw in his office when he was forced to give visas to unqualified applicants. And so here to talk to us about his experiences working for the American Consulate General is J. Michael Springman. Mike Springman, welcome to Visibility 9/11. And tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to be Michael Springman whistleblower.
Okay, well, I understand from talking from some folks at the at Penn State University that people who tend to become whistleblowers, particularly in the national security field, people who work for the State Department or perhaps someone who works for the Central Intelligence Agency, they tend to have a fairly highly developed sense of morality and ethics, and that's probably my undoing because it eventually cost me my job. I had always wanted to work for state, and I got a degree from Georgetown University as Foreign Service School, and I got a degree from another local school in the same field and ended up working for the Commerce Department's International Trade Administration. Didn't much care for it, and I wanted to join the real Foreign Service and kind of fought my way into what became the Foreign Commercial Service when it was created, and then after a couple more years managed to make it to the real State Department and the real Foreign Service. As a reward, I got assigned to Saudi Arabia. to the visa section there at the American consulate in Jeddah. At Jeddah, I really didn't have a whole lot of interest in that part of the world. At the time, I'd been on a lot of posts in a lot of areas of the world, but nothing really in the Middle East. And somehow I was surprised to find I had been assigned there. And before I even got to Saudi Arabia, I began hearing some strange stories about there were problems with the visa section there, but I couldn't really nail them down. The American ambassador, Walter Cutler, had turned what was a what I thought was going to be a five-minute courtesy call, saying, "Hi, I'm part of your new official family. I'll be going out to Jeddah in September," into a 45-minute diatribe about all the problems my predecessor, Greta Holtz, had created for him by refusing visas to unqualified applicants. And he never really went into much detail about this, talking in vague generalities about no Saudi woman can go to the United States without an entourage of servants to dress her hair and iron her clothes and polish her shoes and so forth. And I thought this was really odd. Mentioned it to the State Department desk officer who was charged with following affairs in his country there. And I said, "What is this?" And the guy said, "I have no idea. The ambassador Cutler is just one queer duck." And I heard some things from Ellen Goff later on about visa problems, but she couldn't really put her finger on it. And I started writing my predecessor. I sent her about three letters saying, "What's it like there? What do you wish you had known before you left Washington?" and so forth. No reply. And when I got out there, I was welcomed with open arms. I was feted for being somebody other than Greta Holtz. And I said, "Gee, this woman's going to make my career for me, and I'm not going to have to do anything." But then after a while, people began complaining that I was refusing applications of their friends and people they had recommended and their contacts and so on and so forth. And the Consul General, Jay Freres, who did not work for the Department of State, as I later learned, kept browbeating me about refusing visas. And my refusal rate, according to the computer program we had, was about 5 percentage points of what my predecessor had. But it got to the point where expeditors carrying visa applications from businesses to the consulate would say to me, "You can issue the visas now, or you can issue them after we tell Jay Freres that you refuse the visa and he's going to reverse your decision," which of course was against the Foreign Affairs Manual, which is the State Department's holy book on how things are done, and also against the Immigration and Nationality Act. And I was warned at one point when they had an inspection team coming to see how well the consulate was operating and were they following regulations, that if I said one word about visa issuances and the strange issue of alcohol disappearing at the back door, I would get fired. And one of the inspectors, Joseph P. O'Neill, who I don't think worked for the Department of State, came to me and said, we want you to talk about this, and we'll protect you, and we need you to tell us how to make the government better, and we will protect you." Well, I did. I told him, and then I lost my job. The counselor for consular affairs in Riyadh, Stephanie Smith, who's now retired and living in Florida, the last I heard, told me the things in Jeddah were very serious, and that on my way to my next assignment, I should talk about this to the Bureau of Consular Affairs in Washington. And when I did, nobody had any interest in it. And later on, after learning that the state was going to pitch me out, I went to their inspector general and the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. And diplomatic security agents, one of whom was Travis Moran, told me I simply had had a personality conflict with the Consul General Freres, who, oddly enough, had his own visa plate made so he could issue visas himself, and he would sit at the window, I was told, and interview applicants for visas, which is way below his pay grade. And I thought this was basically visa fraud, which is punishable by a fine of $250,000 and 10 years in prison. And if it's connected to international terrorism, the sentence is increased to 20 years in jail. Well, I learned from Joe Trento, the journalist, a retired government official, and a man connected to a D.C. university, which I'm not going to name for their safety, that this was a major visa scam wherein people were being recruited for the war in Afghanistan against the then Soviets, they were sent to the United States for training and then sent over to Afghanistan once they learned how to shoot things down and blow things up. And one of the people helping them do this was our old friend Osama bin Laden, who is now the devil incarnate, but at one time was a valued CIA asset.
Sure, sure. He's the Emmanuel Goldstein of our day.
So, you know, this is the basics of it. And it got worse instead of better, because I said, okay, I'm going to have a fancy sports car for myself and one for my daughter when I finish suing these people, plus a lot of money in the bank. Well, whenever I went to anybody in the government, when I went to Government Accountability Office, for example, GAO, when I went to the newspapers, nobody wanted to listen to me. And, you know, they didn't want to hear that the consulate in Jeddah was a CIA and NSA operation, the National Security Agency, the folks who make and break codes and eavesdrop on other people's mail. There were only three people, including myself, out of some 20 Americans there, who had no ties to any of the intelligence services.
That's an amazing statement to make, Mike Springman, that the consulate office there in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, was actually run by CIA spooks.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. You know, they've always been infiltrated into the Foreign Service, and I had heard from a former CIA station chief and a former Foreign Service officer who was the last assignment had been the Inspector General's office. They said generally about a third of the people who claim they work for the Department of State don't. They work for the intelligence services. But I'm inclined to think the number is higher, and it probably is still growing. The agency puts people in as his low-level staffers in the consular section, like Andy Weber. He was a guy who worked for the clandestine service, and he was last seen on public television masquerading as an arms inspector in Russia, being interviewed by Judith Miller, the flack who beat the drums for the war in Iraq.
So, Mike, are there ways, or have you been able to prove these assertions that these folks are actually, in essence, a double agent? I guess I wouldn't call them a double agent, but an agent who is actually posing as somebody else, but they're really somebody else. I mean, how do you come upon this information?
You mean the people in the clandestine service at Jeddah?
Yes.
For the most part, they told me.
Wow.
Either they told me themselves, you know, like Eric Quackenbush, the base chief, who's retired now and living in Findlay, Ohio, or I was told by one or two people who may have been Foreign Service officers that Henry Encher, who's living in McLean, Virginia, and supposedly is assigned to the State Department, he worked for the agency, as did his successor, Karen Sasahara. But you know, Frères, nobody knew about him, but then a German journalist, Julius Mader, M-A-D-E-R, had written an article saying that Frères had been with the CIA since he was assigned to Kabul, Afghanistan.
Now, Mike, I want to just back up a little bit, and for those listeners, and I would probably include myself in this bunch, that I'm not really familiar with international travel. I've never traveled outside the U.S. or sought a job anywhere. Why do countries like the United States require foreigners to obtain a visa before they come into the country?
Well, it's a way of controlling who gets in. Most countries, other than the United States, have internal controls. For example, if you go to Germany or Italy or France, you can get into the country without a visa. You just simply show up and present your passport. But when you go to a hotel, if you stay longer than 3 months, you have to register. Well, if you go to a hotel, your registration card is given to the police so that they can put it in a file to see who's there. If you stay there longer than 3 months and become a resident, for whatever reason, you have to register with the local police. With the United States, there's none of this yet, although they're working on it, apparently, from what I see, the Department of Homeland Security and the out-of-control FBI. But basically, in the United States, the controls are external. If you want to come to the United States and you're not part of a low-fraud country like Great Britain or Germany or France or Italy, you have to apply for a visa. And you have to appear at the consulate. You have to fill out paperwork with your passport number, your identity card number, your home address, your telephone number, and where you plan to go in the United States, and do you have any relatives there, like your wife or your brother or your father, or that sort of thing. And these are checked against a lookout list in a computer that has axe murderers and terrorists and crooks all blended into there. And then you have the right to apply for entry at the United States, and the immigration officer at the port of entry reviews the visa and asks you questions and has the right of final decision as to whether you get into the country or not.
I see. So what were your main duties as the chief of the visa division there in Riyadh?
Well, I had a staff of three working for me. They were Lebanese, Indian, and Indonesian. And I would interview the visa applicants and say yes or no and send them on to one of the local staff who was the cashier who took their money. And then applications were entered into the computer system, whether I had approved them or disapproved them and why. And then we give them the visa at the end of the day if it didn't come back with any kind of hit that they were an axe murderer or a rapist or whatever.
I see. So what were some of the common reasons that you used to deny a visa?
Well, it was basically people who essentially talk themselves out of the visa. When you apply for a visa, the idea is you're coming to the United States for a specific purpose, business or tourism. You want to see the Grand Canyon, or you want to do a business deal in New York and buy 1,000 widgets from General Electric. So I talked to them, asked them questions. What do you do in Jeddah? Why are you going to the United States? Where are you going? Who's paying for your trip? And so on and so forth. And by and large, they could not prove they had ties strong enough to bring them back to Saudi Arabia or their own country. A lot of Indians, Indonesians, Pakistanis, and so forth were working there. And if they couldn't show that their ties would bring them back, like a good job, family, property, whatever, they wouldn't get the visa.
I see. So that was kind of like a litmus test, if you will, to find out if they were likely to come home.
Yeah, and basically every applicant was different. I mean, you couldn't have a hard and fast rule with a template, and if you don't match the template, you don't get the visa. It's basically talking to them and then asking probing questions and then trying to figure out what kind of response you're getting.
Sure, sure. Now, Mike, were there any uncommon reasons that didn't happen a lot for denying these visas?
Pretty much no. I mean, I don't ever remember turning up anybody who was listed as a really hardcore criminal or a member of some kind of death squad or terrorist activity or anything like that.
Sure. Now, you mentioned a manual earlier. That
the Foreign Affairs Manual.
What was that?
The Foreign Affairs Manual.
Okay, now that was the instructions that you would basically follow when you're giving these visas, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you started to notice that you were being overridden by your superiors, did you notice any kind of pattern in maybe a consistent reason why they were approving it over your objections?
No, there was no real consistency. In fact, the only consistency was these people were low-level characters who had no legitimate reason for going to the United States.
I see.
You know, the CIA base chief, Quackenbush, came to me one time and said, hey, you know, we're going to send you a visa applicant. You know, he's going to come to the States, but the reason he's going is that he's going to do us in Washington. You know, he's been to the States before. He's got visas, make it look good, wink, wink. Well, the guy, he had a rug business in Jeddah, and he'd been to the States before, and he was going to buy rugs. And the guy was a solid character, and I would have given him the visa anyway. But these other characters, the king's secretary's barber, they wanted a visa for, and I refused, and Furs went crazy over this. And there was a Filipino electrician that they gave a visa to, and I said, well, why? Well, he's been very helpful to the consulate.
I see. So the picture I'm kind of getting here is almost like that of a good old boys club where everybody's scratching everybody's back.
Well, it wasn't that. It wasn't people who wanted to get visas for their contacts to say, see what I can do. You know, I'm your friend. You can tell me anything in confidence, and I can give you something good in return. It wasn't any of that. It was basically visas for unqualified applicants. I mean, they'd send people to me that had never been out of the country and couldn't explain why he wanted to go to some place in the United States.
I see. Now, Mike, what was your first reaction when you started to be overridden and you knew that you were doing your job according to this manual?
Well, I was mad, and I wanted an explanation.
Sure, sure.
I mean, there was, you know, Karen Sasahara, she wanted a visa for a Sudanese guy, and the guy was a refugee from the Sudan and was unemployed in Saudi Arabia, and I said no. And then the chief of the consular section, Justice, his given name, Stevens, issued the visa anyway. I said, Justice, why did you do this? He said, well, whispers, national security. I said, what the hell does that mean? He wouldn't talk about it.
Interesting. So once you began denying the visas and you were overridden, how were you confronted about it? Other than, I guess that sounds like you confronted them, but what were the reasons that they were giving you other than national security?
Well, they didn't. You know, that was only a one-time deal, and it never got an explanation. The rest of it was, it's for the good of the consulate. We want to keep in good graces with the king and the government and this ministry and that ministry. And I said, well, what reason do we have for the King's Secretary's barber getting a visa to go to America? Or for the some Saudi to bring a whole entourage of skilled workers, electricians, carpenters, and so on, to come to the United States and work on his properties here, when he can hire local talent in Chicago or wherever that can do the job? And I never got an explanation. They never bothered to tell me. And I was dumb enough at the time that they had said, well, you know, these are people we've recruited for the Afghan war, and, you know, take care of this for us. I would have been dumb enough to do it.
Well, I would also add, why do they have the manual with the rules and guidelines? And from what I understand, that failure to follow these rules could result in criminal prosecution.
Oh, yeah. You know, my neck on the block was my name was on the visa plate.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, it's the State Department simply is controlled by the CIA. The CIA has a shunt in the State Department's cable room that transfers copies of incoming messages to the Central Intelligence Agency, even though they're directed at the Department of State. But this is not reciprocated, and the state's Bureau of Intelligence Research only gets to look at some of the CIA reporting.
Now, Mike, you were ultimately fired from your job. Can you describe the circumstances surrounding your actual termination?
Well, they actually sent me a letter and said, sorry, we're not going to give you a permanent position in the Department of State. You don't measure up, and that was the end of it. And I tried to find out. I had filed Freedom of Information Act requests, and these were sealed eventually as a threat to national security. And I couldn't quite figure out why me finding out why I was fired somehow translates into national security.
That's pretty heavy. I bet you were quite flattered.
In a way, but I was kind of annoyed, too.
Sure, I totally understand. And so you actually put in FOIA requests, and they were denied again on the national security.
Yeah. By the immigration man,
said he doesn't know if he can. Osama rounded up recruits and sent them into the United States for terrorist training by the CIA. The recruits then returned to fight against Soviet forces. At the height of this operation, the U.S. was shipping 65,000 tons of arms annually to Osama bin Laden's fighters. Pakistani operatives in contact with bin Laden received assistance from American Green Beret commandos and Navy SEALs in various U.S. training establishments, and by 1988, Jane's Defense Weekly reported that, with U.S. knowledge, bin Laden created Al-Qaeda, the base, a conglomerate of quasi-independent Islamic terrorist cells spread across at least 26 countries. When Iraq invaded Kuwait after the fall of the Soviet Union, Osama bin Laden attempted to rally the Saudi royal family to organize civil defense and raise a group of Afghan war veterans to fight against Iraq. This offer was declined, and instead the royal family accepted the stationing of 300,000 U.S. soldiers. This is said to be the point at which Osama chose to become an enemy of the Saudi regime, although, according to a classified intelligence report, a deal was struck with the tacit approval of the CIA that allowed Osama to leave Saudi Arabia with his funding and supporters. The deal also stipulated that funding for his activities would continue, with the caveat that he not target the Saudi kingdom. Al-Qaeda subsequently received increased funding through Saudi Arabia, stronger organizational support from Pakistani intelligence services, and more equipment and training from the CIA. Its network received direct assistance from these three sources, with active and tacit support of Western intelligence agencies, in spreading to 40 countries and conducting pro-Western operations in Macedonia, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Chechnya, and Moscow, Bosnia, the Philippines, Spain, Morocco, Kenya, and others, including the US and United Kingdom. covering key regions where Western interests are at stake: the Balkans, the Caucasus, North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Asia Pacific, all central to control of the Eurasian continent. Thus, in the wake of the Cold War with Russia, U.S. means of statecraft grew more aggressive. Following the departure of Soviet forces, Afghanistan experienced heavy conflict between various factions. Among the most brutal of these was the Northern Alliance, whose portrayal in U.S. media after 9/11 was anything but brutal. By the mid-1990s, several factions joined to form the Taliban movement, which captured Kabul and took power in 1996, reportedly orchestrated by Pakistani intelligence and the oil company Unocal, and approved by the CIA to provide easier oil pipeline negotiations and a greater chance of its successful construction through Afghanistan. In other words, the Taliban were installed because they were easier to bribe than the previous leadership. These negotiations occurred during the mid to late 1990s between the Taliban and current U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, then a UNICAL advisor. The negotiations involved Condoleezza Rice, then an advisor for Chevron, the current president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, then an advisor for UNOCAL, and Enron, which paid $750,000 for the pipeline survey, using a grant funded by U.S. taxpayers. However, the negotiations deteriorated in the year prior to 9/11, leading to a major U.S. invasion plan, for which war games were conducted in January 2001. From February to May 2001, Vice President Dick Cheney gathered executives from the world's major energy corporations for his Energy Task Force meetings. Maps acquired by Judicial Watch show the carving up among these corporations of Iraq's oil fields and much of its other infrastructural assets. In 1993, the bombing of the World Trade Center had led investigators to a wealth of evidence indicating intelligence community complicity and warnings of another, larger attack. In 1995, Project Bojinka, in which 11 commercial jets were to be hijacked and flown into major buildings in the United States, was thwarted, producing another mass of evidence that planes would be used as flying bombs. The top concern of Olympic officials for the 2000 Sydney Games, in fact, was an airliner-based attack by Al-Qaeda. Subsequent investigations strongly indicated that the next attack would be September the 11th, the anniversary of the 1996 conviction of those in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing campaign. Throughout the years leading up to 9/11, especially in the 9 months prior to the attacks, investigators and representatives from dozens of nations and within U.S. borders attempted to warn top White House and U.S. intelligence officials of an attack set for the second week of September 2001 using hijacked planes as flying bombs. All attempts were systematically ignored. Statements by top officials immediately after the attacks that no one was prepared for or could have predicted the events, and that no plans for an invasion of Afghanistan existed, therefore, were lies. In fact, in October 2000, the Pentagon held an evacuation drill with the theme that an airplane had been hijacked and flown into the building. Warned of an impending Al-Qaeda attack on Genoa, Italy, the G8 summit in July 2001, the office of President Bush, who was scheduled to attend, arranged to have the skies cleared and secured, just as they had been for the 2000 Olympic Games. Also in July 2001, U.S. Representative Tom Simons warned Taliban leaders, quote, "We will offer you a carpet of gold or bury you with a carpet of bombs," unquote. So the U.S. had at last put its reinvented post-Cold War international terrorism plan to work, knowingly paving that path to the War on Terror well before it began. This military operation was perfect for those who longed for a new Pearl Harbor for economic gain at the hands of international terrorists. The groundwork was complete, the evil mastermind created, and all that was needed to complete the UNICAL pipeline was a legitimate excuse for taking control of the region. The CIA was still negotiating the pipeline deal in August 2001, while troops were already stationed in surrounding states. Thus, all that was needed was a trigger, a pretext to galvanize public opinion. In June 2001, Paul Wolfowitz's speech to the graduating class at West Point had cited Pearl Harbor and stressed the imminence of a similar surprise. On September the 9th, 2 days before the attacks, President Bush was presented with detailed plans to invade Afghanistan and remove the Taliban before the heavy snowfalls of the Afghan winter. The plans highlighted a global campaign against Al-Qaeda. How long, we must ask, were the Pentagon and CIA drawing up these plans simultaneous to their operations that had created and supported the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the first place? The answer, according to law professor Francis Boyle, is 4 years, with war games and troop gatherings in neighboring states for this invasion commencing in 1997. After September the 11th, top insiders of the military-industrial-academic-congressional think tank complex exploited a fearful electorate, not because of a real threat, but because the door to profits had been kicked open. This is why security has not been improved. Only the spending for war and the price of oil to pay for it have increased, while profits have skyrocketed. According to Ahmed, quote, "A plausible conclusion from all this is that the 2001 to the present day U.S. military campaign in Afghanistan, assisted by Pakistani military intelligence, was not really designed to destroy Al-Qaeda at all. Rather, it was designed to crush the uncooperative Taliban regime in the knowledge that Al-Qaeda would be displaced elsewhere to safety. Fighting a war on terror against Al-Qaeda had never been the real goal of the plans for a military invasion of Afghanistan, which had been formulated years before 9/11. Those plans were motivated by other strategic and economic interests. But the 9/11 terrorist attacks happened to provide a convenient and powerful pretext to implement those plans, as well as other geostrategic imperatives." Unquote. In other words, the U.S. created the threat and, through the resultant fear, the worldwide authoritarian means to pretend to deal with it, while exercising the full scope of its imperial ambitions. This is why the U.S. has more than 750,000 troops in at least 134 countries today. Moreover, that the U.S. knowingly harbored Al-Qaeda cells throughout the 1990s, and up to, if not beyond, 9/11, lends a new perspective to President Bush's post-9/11 promise to, quote, "make no distinction between those who committed these terrible acts and those who harbor them," unquote. On September the 16th, 2001, Osama bin Laden issued a statement to Al Jazeera, quote, "The U.S. government has consistently blamed me for being behind every occasion its enemies attack it. I would like to assure the world that I did not plan the recent attacks, which seem to have been planned by people for personal reasons." Unquote. Evidence appears to support his contention that 9/11 was not a result of his orders, but rather a convenient outcome of manipulation of people within his sphere of influence by oil company representatives, intelligence services, and others in preceding years. And speaking of Enron, it is Professor Peter Dale Scott's opinion that the American people remain traumatized by the 2000 election, a crisis that was substantially influenced by Enron's interests in Afghanistan. Enron paid Christian Coalition President Ralph Reed $500,000 to stop John McCain's campaign, and was the biggest donor to the Bush campaign. Enron was also one of the largest donors to the Gore campaign. It is plausible that 9/11 was on the table of persons other than Osama bin Laden, especially in the light of revelations regarding 9/11 complicity of top-level American Airlines officials at its center in Fort Worth, Texas. Regardless, Professor Scott is correct in stating that we're living in an atmosphere which creates the possibility for minorities to govern acquiescent majorities. Covert power produces fallout similar to nuclear power. Trained terrorists turn on their former trainers, the criminal complicity of governments which hinders prosecution of such people, and society's overall corruption. The result is deep politics, the immersion of public life in an immobilizing substratum of unspeakable scandal and bad faith, and the result in practice is 9/11. The fallout of training people how to blow things up and kill others gives them an upper hand, because secrets are shared that cannot be revealed in the homeland, in this case the US. All parties complicit agree not to implicate one another. Americans had double agents in Al-Qaeda and in the Project Bojinka group, the Philippines' Abu Sayyaf, which merged and melded with Al-Qaeda from the very beginning. Double agents became triple agents, and their intermediaries are up to their own misdeeds or simply unable to report all the information to their superiors. All in all, with Enron's stake in the Central Asian republics and Halliburton, Unocal, Chevron and so on, and the 2000 election, the best possible outcome for those who were put in office and setting conditions for the indefinite control of the majority in the US was 9/11, legitimizing entry into the region on a massive scale, whether engineered or not. The Cold War phenomenon of a foreign policy driven more by domestic politics than concerns for national security has, in the transition to war on terror, become reversed. Domestic policies are in large part driven today by the peripheral effects of, and blowback from, the rise to prominence of a grand neo-manifest destinarian vision. In the words of Bruce Cummings, "Not since McKinley seized the Philippines have we had a president who justifies his aggression by virtue of an open pipeline to God." This points to an almost self-fulfilling prophecy or cultivation of an international terrorist threat as envisioned by the JCIT back in 1979, again invented and then reinvented not to counter Soviet actions but, quote, "useful for demonizing threats to the prevailing U.S.-dominated capitalist economic system," unquote. The crux of Philip Paul's thesis is that the JCIT represented a precisely coordinated and globally oriented propaganda network for the purposes of selling a pretext for war. This is what the so-called war on terror really is. And Americans would not have accepted it without a massive media propaganda effort accompanying an attack against the United States, or with the kind of enlightenment about such tyrannical behavior that a truly competent education system should provide. Democrat and Republican administrations have been equally complicit in using invented threats as a cover for imperial expansion. No fundamental changes in this pattern have occurred as a result of the election of a new president, ever. The current Bush administration has made the most effective use of the ideology of international terrorism. The only difference is that the Soviet Union, as the alleged sponsor, has been replaced by the newly invented and CIA-approved transnational Islamist threat at taxpayer expense. This point is crucial. Power in the United States is conventionally believed to be derived from the consent of the governed, yet the governed have unknowingly paid the salaries of every Taliban leader and member, and thus tacitly supported the immense suffering under their leadership, paid for Pakistani intelligence services, paid for pipeline surveys and construction, paid for CIA and Pentagon black operations and negotiations between U.S. representatives and Taliban leaders, paid for every gun and bullet used in installing and removing them, and for everything throughout the Cold War and since that had nothing to do with promoting the general welfare. This small story of Afghanistan is just the tip of the tyranny iceberg. For example, since abandoning the democratization of Japan in 1952, in favor of using it as a permanent military base, the U.S. continues to pay Japan and other nations with the exportation of technology and jobs lost in the U.S. in exchange for acquiescence to and support for the U.S. military presence of some 100,000 troops in East Asia. Nearly all of these wars and external threats are and have been for U.S. economic gain in various regions of the world. Corporations feed on profits from conflict and the threat of conflict. In my research, I went looking for companies on the Pentagon payroll, expecting to find weapons manufacturers. But, in a stroke of lucrative genius, Dick Cheney had begun the outsourcing boom of every aspect of militarism to the private sector before leaving office in January 1993 by commissioning Halliburton to conduct a study on hiring firms to move U.S. forces abroad rapidly. Halliburton itself responded by accepting the task of transporting troops to Somalia, and by subsequently hiring Cheney, who, while in public service, nevertheless continues to receive kickbacks from Halliburton. The Clinton administration then fueled the boom with great zeal, hiring Halliburton to assist in outsourcing everything from milkshakes and missiles to all beef patties with special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, and onions on sesame seed buns. During the Cold War with Russia, U.S. weapons production was dispersed among the 50 states to motivate representatives to continually approve weapons programs for the sake of jobs in their respective states, however wasteful these weapons were for the taxpayer, however destructive they were to social progress. But from the 1990s outsourcing, I found more than 300,000 companies on the Pentagon payroll, including Campbell's Soup, Avon Cosmetics, Bumblebee Seafood, and Hallmark Cards. I also found more than 350 universities amongst these companies. San Diego City proper has 3,600 DOD-dependent companies, including 12 colleges. In my town, Eugene, Oregon, there are 56 companies on the Pentagon payroll, including my school, the University of Oregon. In Lowell, Oregon, with a population of 750 people, 10 companies work for the Pentagon, and whether they make shovels, ladders, or gun barrels, that small town pulls in $1.5 million a year, making it a junior partner in the structure of dependence on militarism, not to mention less likely to question the aggressive actions of its government. Moreover, many board members of the largest consumer product firms also sit on the boards of the largest media and defense corporations. America's top industry since 1950 has been weapons. The U.S. is addicted to conflict, and in a capitalist society, profits must escalate. Thus, it was remarkably profitable for the Bush administration to invent an axis of evil in a famous January 2002 speech, despite the complete falsehoods employed in doing so. By 2002, Iraq, as is now widely known, was a nation on its knees. Iran had undergone a 12-year pro-democracy reformation in the wake of the Iran-Iraq War, with women performing a far greater role in society than ever before. North Korea had signed an agreement with the Clinton administration in 1994 that halted its nuclear ambitions, provided a window for reunification with South Korea, and would have led to the removal of U.S. forces. Therein lies the reason for the Bush administration breaking of this agreement and the inclusion of North Korea in the Axis of Evil speech. With that one speech, all three nations became external threats, alienating them immediately, and thus to an extent fulfilling Bush's assertion that they are anti-American. The fact that North Korea today insists on direct talks with Washington alone indicates that the issue for North Korea is about the breaking of the previous agreement. The fact that the U.S. insists on bringing four additional nations into the discussion can thus be seen as an effort to legitimize the status quo of U.S. forces in South Korea and the separation of North and South. The recent U.S. response to the testing of missiles by North Korea illustrates the extent to which deceit is employed in White House rhetoric to maintain military forces abroad. The rhetoric is designed to suggest that the world community is united with the Bush administration's determination to maintain a military presence in South Korea, and that indeed it is North Korea that is refusing to be rational in joining the world community as a separate nation, while the previous 1994 agreement framework and the desire on the part of both North and South to reunify without the presence of U.S. forces are rendered as non-issues. Even before the tests were over, Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill asserted that not only were nations united against North Korea's actions, but that North Korea was stubbornly refusing a rational solution, as if the previous agreement had never existed. Just about every responsible country in the world weighed in against it. So the first thing they've done is to unite us all. Well, the provocation is that, you know, we put out last September a pretty in-depth agreement, an agreement in principle, on how we could denuclearize North Korea, and in return, they would be offered an open road into the international community. And so, instead, they seem to want to go in another direction. In reality, by breaking the 1994 agreement, it is the Bush administration that has chosen another direction. Moreover, out of the group of six nations the Bush administration has tasked to settle the situation, aside from the US and North Korea itself, two, Japan and South Korea, are essentially US military states, far from being capable of issuing opposing opinions on the matter, and the other two, China and Russia, are anything but united or aligned with the Bush administration's position. This is well known, and Hill touches on it in his own statements, which, as seen between the lines, and in light of statements by China and Russia, carry a heavy degree of condescension toward the two larger powers and attempts to force North Korea into international organizations that the US clearly dominates. The six parties, you know, originally, or back in the 1990s, we were trying to deal with this bilaterally, and it was basically the US and North Korea, and the US and North Korea was not prepared, really, to reach agreement. So Japan is a part of that. South Korea is a part of that. China and Russia are all part of the six-party process. And the point is that when we reach settlement, and I do believe that at some point we will reach a settlement, all of these parties have a role to play. I mean, we are very concerned about this, that we have been talking to our South Korean allies, our Japanese allies, and we're going to start having some in-depth discussions with the Chinese. And we're going to see what we can do. Part of the draft, the September agreement, was that North Korea needs energy. Well, South Korea is going to be providing them energy. They need economic assistance. Japan was prepared, under the September agreement, to provide that kind of economic assistance. We are prepared to help them, help North Korea get into international organizations. The US position, as seen in Hill's comments, can also be seen as a pretext for pushing missile defense. So, it is a provocation. I mean, we're obviously going to have to be working with our partners about how to protect ourselves. After all, we had a little country firing off six missiles in different directions. You know, clearly this is a threat to a number of countries in the region. So, we have to look at the whole issue of how to defend ourselves. Again, Bruce Cummings helps illustrate the dangers inherent in concentrating power in the hands of a few. In a classic article in 1941, Harold Lasswell defined the garrison state as one in which the specialists on violence are the most powerful group in society. North Korea is a classic garrison state, perhaps the best example in world history of a thoroughly militarized nation. And this was their unfortunate answer to the defining crisis of the regime, occupation by an American army. But we are also well advanced towards a national security-dominated system, making the country of the Founding Fathers unrecognizable, above all to them. It can be safely argued that a fourth and permanent peak in Alan Wolfe's ups and downs of military postures and rhetorical gestures arrived in the form of official statements following the events of September 11, 2001, and in national security documents under the Bush administration beginning in 2002 and culminating with the Quadrennial Defense Review and National Security Strategy of 2006, which openly declare a long global war to rid the world of evil and cite several future enemies, including China. These public documents, to which the public is largely oblivious, have deep roots in NSC 68. The rhetorical summation of NSC 68 as a blueprint for all subsequent scary documents intended to motivate citizens and representatives alike can be observed in a single sentence, typifying Paul Nitzer's style. The Soviet Union, unlike previous aspirants to hegemony, is animated by a new fanatic faith antithetical to our own and seeks to impose its absolute authority over the rest of the world. In light of the fact that Paul Wolfowitz began working closely with Paul Nitzer in 1969, it's of interest to compare that statement with these excerpts from an April 2004 speech by Paul Wolfowitz, honoring Paul Nitzer at the Johns Hopkins University's Paul Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies, where Wolfowitz had both taught and served as dean during the Clinton years. When Don Rumsfeld and I had lunch with the members of the 9/11 Commission recently, one member asked what they could do to ensure that their report would make a real difference. What I told them, basically, was to write something similar to George Kennan's long telegram or Paul Nitzer's NSC 68. I hope that we might agree that the phenomenon of terrorist fanaticism has presented itself to us with such a horrible and menacing face that we need to confront it with the same openness of mind and depth of vision that a young Paul Nitzer confronted the menace of Soviet communism with more than 50 years ago. Like 50 years ago, there is an urgency and a need to act. As NSC 68 explained so well, the Soviet threat was not just military, but ideological. In some ways, the ideology of terrorist fanaticism is even more dangerous. With them, we face an enemy who hides amongst the shadows, shifting positions and methods with the wind. As they go about their ugly business, they exploit the freedom of open societies. There is one constant, however, across half a century, theirs too, is the ideology of evil. But today we face an enemy that not only hates freedom, it hates life itself and worships death. This is not about America imposing its values on other people. It's about America enabling other people to enjoy the values from which we benefit so enormously. In other words, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz had lunch with members of the 9/11 Commission, tasked with investigating government failures, during its deliberations, whereupon Wolfowitz advised them to write what was essentially a declaration of war. It is a fact that Iraq was discussed with the Bush cabinet just hours after the attacks on 9/11, and it is a fact that 2 months later, during the bombing campaign in Afghanistan, President Bush asked Donald Rumsfeld to begin plans for invading Iraq. What we are left with, then, with this long war to rid the world of evil, is a permanent state of defense build-up and preparation for advanced warfare, and other lucrative perpetual peaks of power assertion via real interventions and official and belligerent Pentagon strategies. And that, I'm afraid, is where we're going to have to leave it for this episode. Due to time, we shall probably conclude the essay next week. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. When I started making episodes 5 years ago, I was counting in hundreds. We're now looking at thousands of downloads per episode. So, my hearty appreciation if you've been helping to spread awareness of this show. If you're new to the show, we have 15 years of material archived and available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive.